Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to another newly recorded episode of Free Forum, a world that just might work. And I'll be speaking today with Paul Hawken, an entrepreneur of both the business and social variety, a challenging and inspiring speaker, and a best-selling author whose latest book is Regeneration, Ending the Climate Crisis in One Generation. And you can learn more at paulhawken.com, that's P-A-U-L-H-A-W-K-E-N, one word, paulhawken.com, and regeneration.org. Show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 in L.A., streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Podomatic, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. I first interviewed today's guest, Paul Hawken, in 2007 on his book, Natural Capitalism, which he co-authored with Amory Lovins. Though we'd met over his earlier work, The Ecology of Commerce, I've interviewed him a number of times since. Our paths often cross, and we've even worked together on occasion. As a species, we've survived and flourished because we're social, we plan, we collaborate. When I think about society successfully taking on the handful of major crises we face, pandemics, inequality, democracy, tribalism, and climate change, I'm drawn to a quote from Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, best known for The Little Prince. The quote, "If you want to build a ship, don't drum up the men to gather wood, divide the work, and give orders. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea." And I believe Paul is determined to find ways to invite and tap that yearning. His latest offering, the book Regeneration, and an organization dedicated to making that a reality. We'll talk today about the state of the climate crisis, the opportunities, solutions, possibilities to effectively confront it, as well as how to overcome the obstacles to doing so. Regeneration expands the scope of our response to the challenge of climate change by linking and weaving it with the other challenges we face, and by placing love of life at the center of all we do. Paul Hawken has founded several companies, starting in the 60s with Erewhon Trading, one of the first natural food companies in the U.S., Smith & Hawken, a retail and catalog company, One Sun, an energy company focused on ultra-low-cost solar. As an author, his books include Growing a Business, The Ecology of Commerce, Blessed Unrest, Natural Capitalism, Drawdown, the book from 2017, Drawdown, the most comprehensive plan ever proposed to reverse global warming, and the latest, Regeneration, Ending the Climate Crisis in One Generation. Welcome again, Paul Hawken, to Free Forum, a world that just might work.
Hey, Terrence, that's a great introduction. Didn't get better than that.
All right. Thank you. Let me tell people, we're recording this conversation Friday, October 15th. So, as I said, you're both a social and a business entrepreneur. You lead organizations as well as companies. You're an author, a speaker. How do you see your work and how your work has evolved? What's the thread, the narrative of what Paul Hawken's about?
Curiosity.
I like it. I like it.
No, seriously, we all are, what's the word? Surfeited with information, buffeted by the, ins and outs of the world. You know, we're challenged in, different ways as individuals, as families, in our vocations, as students, etc. All these things are the human condition. And for me, it's always been a question of, well, what's going on? Why is this happening? I feel actually slow in that sense. You're like, duh, huh, I don't get it. And why do people act that way? Mm-hmm. Why do we trash the planet, and call it money? These seem like, elementary questions or sort of, but these are things we sort of overlook, we just assume or accept things the way they are. And as a child, I've always been really curious about why things are, quote, quote, the way they are. In other words, why do we do think, act in such ways that are not in our best interest, or that we think are in our best interest but actually are not? And you hit it right on the nail right on the head right in the beginning when you said we are social creatures. We are. We're Homo sapiens, and we are here as the hominid species that actually prevailed over Homo floridiensis and Neanderthal because of our desire and willingness to work together, learn together, collaborate together, solve problems together, celebrate together, create dance, music, and art together, ritual together. I mean, that's who we are, you know. And so it's surprising when we sort of break out and do things that anyway conflict with our communal or community best interests. And that's kind of what we're doing today, no question.
Yeah. Let me just mention a couple of books I've come across lately that talk a bit about that. One is Humankind by Rutger Bregman. I don't know if you... And another, Survival of the Friendliest. And they both sort of look at that, what turns out now to be sort of a counter impression of who we are as a species. But I agree with you. I mean, we agree. It is who we are.
Absolutely. I mean, Humankind, the title is broken into two words, you know.
Yes. So. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So let's first sort of set up where we are in relation to the climate crisis. And let me set it up in a couple of ways. One is how things might have changed since 2017, when your last book and organization, Drawdown, emerged. And then let me just read just a little bit about the most recent IPCC report. IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, body of the UN. In the 8 years since the last comprehensive IPCC report and 6 years since the Paris Accords, humanity's output of heat-trapping gases has actually grown. Even with the dip in emissions stemming from the COVID-19 pandemic, carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere reached a record high this year, topping 419 parts per million, a level the planet has not seen for at least 2 million years. And so that's been the latest official word on where we stand. Your take on where we are and where we've come in the last 4 years.
Well, what we've experienced is the overwhelming inertia of the neoliberal capitalist system, you know, which can say the right things, but commitments, pledges, net zero goals, targets are not action. They're words.
Yep.
And I would say that there's been very little action in the last 4 years. There's certainly been an increase in awareness, especially in the last maybe 12, 16 months amongst humanity in general. And there's definitely a quickening a pace right now on the corporate level, I suppose on the government level. We'll see in what happens in the next few weeks. But again, that is still revolving around commitments and almost workarounds, you know. In other words, well, we're gonna fix our supply chain so that they stop deforestation or do this or that and so forth. But nobody's addressed the fact that the business as usual assumptions. When we look at the climate projections about temperature increments and the impacts of those increments will have on living systems, the oceans, you know, migration, food, drought, etc. Those projections are all based on an assumption which is called business as usual. The business as usual scenarios come from the World Bank, from the International Energy Agency, from even the IPCC. And the business as usual assumes that the economy will be 2.3 times bigger by 2050 and 7 times bigger than it is today by 2100. So that is kind of the background that we don't talk about. You know, we talk about the impacts of the existing economic system and humankind's activity therein. But what we don't talk about is the juggernaut that is driving it. And if you look at, if you really look at the language around, let's call it the techno-optimist school of, which is led, not led, but certainly epitomized by Bill Gates, David Keith at Harvard, carbon engineering, these ideas that somehow we can solve the problems technology has created by creating ever newer technologies, and the idea that it's an it, we're going to fix it, that's a air quotes on it, what's it? And so that language really is very much about assuming that the economy and the way we live and our roads and our cars and our homes and our houses and our, junkets and travel and, all the things that basically the privileged do and certainly the middle class in much of the world, can continue as is and will continue to grow. And so that isn't discussed. What's discussed is, impact for sure, and the idea that we have to change this and do this and reduce our impact and reduce, use of fossil fuels, coal, gas, and oil for sure. But, and that's all true. But what we don't talk about is the economic system itself.
Yeah. Or at least what I think expands on what you just said is that there is acceptable conversations in the mainstream media, mainstream politics, mainstream culture, and challenging the system as a pathway forward is just not within that conversation. I mean, clearly you and I talk to people, read people, have colleagues who raise those questions. It just is not in the mainstream conversation.
No, yeah. Consumption is a given.
Yeah,
we just have to change how we consume or what we consume or what it's made of or how we derive the raw materials, etc. But that's like true. I mean, we do have to change all those things, no question about that. But the overall level of consumption is unquestioned.
Yeah, growth is taken for granted. Growth is a good.
Well, growth and gross, GROSS, which is gross domestic product, yep. GDP, right? Gross. And it's an interesting word. And that is the bellwether. I mean, that is the thing that, banks and economists, there's the pivot around that number. Is it growing? Is it not growing? And what happens if it doesn't grow and all that sort of stuff. So basically, we have not imagined an economy that can grow and create prosperity for people and not destroy life.
Yes, right, right. An economy that meets needs, that provides services, that makes for an ability to thrive without the destruction of nature being just a necessity to get there.
Yeah, because we have an economic system, and no matter what product you're talking about or the service that you may be receiving, if you pull the string on the supply chain bag and open it up and look at it, don't go very far before you find out that it is taking life, harming life, destroying life. And that's true for every single economic sector in the world. So when you take life, that's degeneration. That's what degeneration is. You're reducing life, okay? And what's happened now, and I think especially in the last couple of years, you asked what happened since 2017, but one awareness I think is coming to the fore is that we can see the end of the road and degeneration. Now, scientists and biologists have been seeing that for a long time and talking about it, but I think there's a greater appreciation now on a corporate level, on a political level, and certainly on many other levels. Whoa, the road dead ends. Why are we going there? It's a cul-de-sac. And it is, because you're destroying life. And so one of the things is that we keep talking about new renewable energy, which is crucial, no question, because combustion of coal, gas, and oil is 80% of our carbon dioxide emissions. But we talk about it as if we swap it out for renewable, which we are doing, and I think we'll do successfully and so forth, that somehow we get a hall pass to the 22nd century. We're cool. You know, it's okay. We've made it and so forth. And it's just, that's just not true. And we have to do those things as well. I'm not gainsaying that at all. I'm just saying is that what we're not looking at is the system as a whole. And so right now we're stealing the future. And that's what the economic system's doing, is taking the future and selling it in the present and calling it GDP, okay? And we're so accustomed to it that it's almost unquestioned and so forth. So the question regeneration poses and the, what it proposes as a possibility in turn is like doing a 180 pivot. That is to say, because we have to. We're going to have to do it sooner or later, or we won't even be here. But we cannot continue to go down the road of degeneration. We have to think about what is a regenerative economy? What does it mean? And as you said in your introduction, it means putting life at the center of every act and decision. So then we have to think, well, is it possible? Can we create an economy that is prosperous, that creates living wage jobs for people, that meets human needs, you know, that creates more life instead of less life? And the answer is absolutely yes. No question about it. So we can have a GDP that heals the future and as opposed to steals it. And the lack of imagination here is, again, goes back to the inertia and the momentum of the people, the bankers, the financiers, the professors, the teachers, the old school believers in industrial ag and all so forth. There's this tremendous sort of intellectual, if you can call it intellectual, but beliefs, you know, that are also part of the inertia of the system itself, when in fact, you have many, many examples of techniques and practices and that actually show that we can go the other way. And it's going to be more successful because when you add more life, when you create more life in your act of creating economic well-being and so forth, you actually create a future that grows and expands in its potential and capabilities.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You finish with the same word they use, which is, it's about growth, but it's a growth of real value, of a growth of real experience, and not right. just a growth of numbers
or stuff.
Yeah, or stuff. Can I? When I was thinking about this conversation, Paul, I want to ask you something. Which, in other words, when I asked you then, how has your thinking changed? What I heard, I think, was not that any of these realizations are actually new to you, that the system and the what's taken for granted and the business as usual sort of marches on unquestioned while we tinker with solutions and things around the edge and so on. But what seems to have changed is that you've taken sort of another step backwards and widened your vision in how you look at all of that. One of the things that it's been my experience is that you often seem to develop a take, if you will, on a challenge, be it usually it's some of them have been business challenges, some of them culture challenges, a lot of them have been environmental challenges or climate, and how to respond to that challenge. You may find a solution or a recommended path of action. And then you do your best to spread the word and often invite participation, as you did with Drawdown, as you did with Regeneration. Then a few years later, you have a different take. How has that, when you look back at that process from, let's say, ecology of commerce, natural capitalism, blessed unrest, Drawdown, Regeneration, when you look back at how Paul Hawkins' take on these things and approach on these things has evolved, what do you see?
Somebody pointed out something to me once, which surprised me. But if you read The Ecology of Commerce, you read the last chapter, it points directly to basically natural capitalism. If you read, if you read the last part of Natural Capitalism, last chapter which I wrote, it goes straight to Blessed Unrest. If you read the last chapter of Blessed Unrest, it actually points to Drawdown. Drawdown, the last essay I wrote in that one, points to regeneration, actually. So it's interesting to me, I say that not as like I had this premonition. I didn't. Absolutely didn't. It's like I look back in hindsight and say, oh my gosh, I was thinking about that. So actually there is a continuity between those books, which I was embodying, I suppose, and expressing, but not realizing that I had, in a sense, written an augury, you know, of the future. But regeneration in that case, though, was actually, I knew I was going to do that before I had finished Drawdown. I knew it was the sequel. And the reason for that is Drawdown was originated in 2001 in my mind, when the third assessment came out. And I went around, you know, to friends and big NGOs, environmental NGOs and institutions, and said, we should really map, measure, and model the most substantive solutions. And the other thing to climate, and the other thing was we should name the friggin' goal. Because then as now, people are using verbs as goals, tackling, combating, conquering, fighting, you know, and going, really? That's not a goal. And that's just male metaphors, you know. And like the goal is to reverse global warming. And so can we name the goal, please? So that's what Drawdown is. It's the first time on a year-to-year basis where greenhouse gases peak and go down. But so I wanted to name the goal. Then I wanted to know, could we get it? Could we achieve it? Do we have the means at hand, you know, extant solutions that we understood and that we could scale, that we're scaling? And I went around for years talking to people about this, and I got good feedback and appreciation. Nobody said it was a bad idea. They said it was a good idea, but they didn't do it, or they didn't have the funds to do it. They didn't know how to do it, you know, fair enough. And so finally, I forgot about it until Bill McKibben wrote that piece in 2013 in Rolling Stone, Global Warming's Terrifying New Math. And I think, as you remember, Terrence, I mean, what he did was take the work that Mark Campanelli had done at a Carbon Tracker in London. And Mark had taken the balance sheets of every coal, gas, and oil company he could get his hands on. Some of them are private. And he's analyzed their, quote, assets, that is, their proven reserves of oil, gas, coal, and totaled that up and said that's unburnable carbon. He coined that term, which is unburnable because if we burn it, we'll destroy ourselves. So why is it an asset? And so, good question.
Yes.
And what Bill did in his article is saying, he set a match to it. It was like a hypothetical match, and then told you what would happen. And it was freaky. It was terrifying. It was a brilliant piece.
It was.
It really was.
I interviewed Bill last week, and in the introduction, I mentioned that article. In other words, he's written all these books. He started 350, but I think one of his signature achievements was that article.
Yeah, no question. People came to me all over who are activists and, you know, very effective ones at that. And they use the same word, which is game over. Maybe it's game over. You know, we tried to, you know, alert the public, blah, 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 and all the things that activists do and did and did well in this case. But I was noticing they used the same term and they didn't know each other. You know, the word occurred to them spontaneously. And I was thinking about my friends who are been in addiction programs, you know, AA and stuff like that. I have never been in one myself, but not that I shouldn't have been for workaholism, but just I have the one sanctioned addiction in the world,
that's
workaholism.
Right. Yeah.
But that surrendering, that giving up is actually the beginning of transformation. In other words, you have to give up. And so I thought, God, people are giving up. So maybe it's game on. That was my surmise. And so in 2014, I got together with initially Amanda Joy Ravenhill, and I had a 501c3 that was sitting on the shelf, and I said, let's resuscitate that and create Project Drawdown, my name for it, you know. And Drawdown, by the way, as a term, was sort of buried in the climate literature. I didn't coin that term or invent it at all. It was there and described reversing global warming, but nobody was talking talking about it. So it was called Project Rana. And then we hired Chad Fishman to head our research. And we worked together and brought in Crystal Chazelle, a wonderful African-American woman from Maryland who is a lawyer, was a mayor, extraordinary human being. And together we marshaled the work of student scientists. I mean, I say students, they were postdocs and graduate students from all over the world, six continents, almost 70 different scientists, and about 120 plus advisors. And we brought them together because we felt like this should be a we talking to the we, not a me, somebody look at, I know you don't listen up. That was, that doesn't work. And so even though I wrote almost most of the book, I mean, you know, and my name's on the cover for sure, you know, but the point being is I put editor instead of author because I wanted to make emphasize the collaborative nature of this work that we were doing. And it was very collaborative. And we did exactly that. We measured and modeled the most substantive solutions. And it was fascinating, Terrence, because we were doing it during the Conference of the Parties in Paris, and staff people went there. And we realized as we started to do this that no one knew the top 5 or 10 solutions to reversing global warming. I mean that.
Wow. Like,
oh, yeah. Wow. I mean, you just go, oh, come on. Of course we know. No, we didn't. And so we asked people in Paris, you know, can you name the top 5 in any order or the top 10? And nobody could. They couldn't even name 5 in some cases or name 10. Much less, you know, the
prioritize
most substantive
them, yeah.
ones. Yeah. So here we are, I mean, 21 years in, or 20 years at that, the 21 years into the climate crisis on the Conference of the Party, 50 years in the public sphere, and we didn't know what the solutions were. I mean, it is crazy. We knew what not to do. We knew what the causes were. It was to stop cutting trees, stop, you know, belching CO2 in the atmosphere from combustion of fossil fuels. We knew that. But we didn't know what to do.
Wow.
And so, I know. And so that's
I mean, it's
why...
funny because, of course, I read Drawdown. We talked about it, blah, blah, blah. But I think even today when you say that, I'm still shocked.
It was shocking. And then... I asked a lot of people myself outside of the Paris Agreement, you know,
yeah,
and they were like, oh, well, you know, I mean, they gave some, you know, the typical bromides, you know, about renewable energy and stuff like that. But there was no one knew. And I didn't either, by the way. So, I mean, let's be clear.
Yeah.
We didn't either. You know, we were like, and then as we began, when people came back from Paris and so forth, I mean, and I confessed to being a little bit smug at that time to myself and saying, well, I know what they are, because we could sort of see the landscape shaping up. And I was dead to rights wrong, by the way.
That's right. I remember that. By the way, it is so much of what the territory we're talking right now goes back to, as you said, curiosity, right?
Yes. Yeah.
It is that question. But yes, so you had your guess that you thought were right, and they weren't right. And you were quite surprised with what made up the top 10.
Very much so. And we didn't really know until just like a month before we had to go to press, because we laid out the book. We did it, designed it. I chose the photographs, you know, we did the kerning, the leading, the typeface, the font, the layout, all that sort of stuff. So we could put in the numbers at the last moment. And when we hit the total button, because the model is not siloed, it's interactive, it's a system. And
oh,
so
right, of course.
Yeah, and then we hit the total button, we're going, what? And then we were so surprised that we went back and started to check some areas where we might have made a mistake, we couldn't find the mistake. And so, okay, so there's Drawdown, and then you publish it by order, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, something that is very appealing to Americans.
Yes, you know, we love lists.
Yeah, we love lists. And, but I very intentionally kept it siloed. We just do the math. This is the math, you know, we map, measure, and model. Here it is. And, but I knew then I was going to do regeneration, because actually Drawdown doesn't tell you how to get it done. It tells you what can be done. there's a real difference.
Yes, yes. And I think, let me even ask you this question, which is, in the ways your perspective or your thinking has changed, and even what you just said is part of it, is that it's a different question since Drawdown. If you were doing Drawdown together, how would it be different?
And then we'll do it.
And then we'll shift to regeneration.
I wouldn't do Drawdown any different than it was done.
Aha.
Because it was intentionally narrow. Because look, if you do a book and you try to do too many things, you know, it just falls, it collapses of its own weight. I mean, it's like you want to stick to your knitting. You want to stay in your lane. Describe the lane. Here's our lane. This is what we did. And here's the data. Here's the, you know, here's the website, all that stuff. But I knew I put on constraints on Drawdown because I knew regeneration was, among many things, how to get it done. And I gave 128 speeches after Drawdown was published in 22 months. And I learn so much, because you never learn anything when your mouth is open. You learn from questions. Questions are gold to me from people. And they're
so the Q&A section of your speeches was the real money shot.
That's the payback for me. That's the payoff. You know, it wasn't like here's your honorarium. The honorarium was the questions, because that makes you think. And you know, when people ask a question, they're usually asking it for many other people as well. They don't know that. That's their question. But many other people, you can see them even in an audience nodding, going, yeah, yeah, I mean, me too, and so forth. And so regeneration definitely was fed by that. And the fact is, people said, what should I do? And people didn't know what to do, and they didn't know how to do it. Such an interesting question. It came up, I would say, 90% of the time, when there was a full Q&A session. And even my wife said, because she almost lost me in Drawdown, you disappeared, you know, and then I said, oh, I'm doing regeneration. And she looked at me, she's Italian-Argentinian, she means it when she says something. She said, she said, if you don't tell me what to do and how to do it in this book, I'm leaving you.
I like, love it. Makes it personal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, by the way, let me just share one thing. I produced with the Harvard Alumni Association a series of conversations on climate. And they were really conversations. One thing you'll appreciate, Paul, is that we had each panel consisted of alumni, students, and faculty as equals, which, as you can imagine, is quite a radical change for the Harvard Alumni Association. But what I'm going to say is that the most common question, because we of course, when we sent out the invitation, when you got your reservation, it said, and do you have questions for the panel? What do I do? Was by far the most common question. Absolutely.
Well, it gets even more interesting, because before regeneration, I analyzed who's doing anything. And between 98 and 99% of the people isn't doing anything, is disengaged from action around the greatest crisis civilization has ever faced, and hopefully may ever face. And you go, oh my God, that's not true. It is true.
Wow.
And half of those people, of that 98, 99%, are sympathetic. I mean, they get it. In one way or another, you know, they understand it's anthropogenic, you know, wholly or partially causative. They understand the impacts. They understand the dangers therein. They understand that, you know, we all have a role in it, and they don't do anything at all.
Wow.
So it's so interesting. And that's why I say in the book, there's no difference between, from the Earth's point of view, from a denier and somebody who knows about it and does nothing. They're the same thing from the Earth's point of view, right?
Of course, right. And from the future's point of view, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So let me tell people, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Paul Hawken, entrepreneur, author. We're talking about his latest book, Regeneration, Ending the Climate Crisis in One Generation, and you can learn more. I'm going to give you two websites, paulhawken.com, in which you get kind of a sense of his whole career, all his books, that sort of thing. That's Paul and Hawken, Hawken, paulhawken.com. And about regeneration, which is a book, but it's much, much more than a book. The website is brand new, but still quite robust in offering access to information, solutions, community, all of that sort of thing. That is at regeneration.org. Let me read a quick quote of yours, which I think is one thing that is behind regeneration for you. And you have said, solving the climate crisis is an unnatural act, one that human beings are ill-equipped to do. Our minds just don't work that way. On the other hand, as I said in the introduction, humans are notably brilliant at joining together to solve problems. And this is the killer. If we want to get the attention of humanity, humanity needs to feel it is getting attention. And that really is at the core of regeneration, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, statistically, there's 4.3 billion people in the world who live in impoverished conditions. They're called poor people. They're not. They're just in. They're people living in poor conditions. Okay. But those people, I mean, the climate conversation has been about future existential threat. We should do this and this and that, you know, otherwise we face future existential threats to our way of life. Okay. Well, the brain doesn't work that way. The brain is not about future existential threat. I mean, you wouldn't be here, nor would anybody listening be here today, if their ancestors were thinking about future existential threat. They were thinking and did very well with respect to current existential threat. That's who's here today. And that's the way our brains are wired. And current existential threat is warmth, heat, safety, food, etc. We know all those things. And those were pressing concerns for people all over the world for a long time. And today, most of the world actually is still concerned about current existential threat. And so if we're not aware of that and not addressing that, then you can kiss the climate movement goodbye, because it's not going to be effective. And the curious thing, or the wonderful thing, is that when you look at the website, and we have Nexus, this thing is called, but it's the most complete listing and network of climate solutions and how to get them done in the world. This is it. It's the solutions from drawdown, from regeneration. There's a lot of new ones there and some others. But if you took away our understanding of extreme weather, climatology, you know, if we were clueless about all that, and we would want to do every single one of these solutions because they absolutely have this cascading beneficial impact for people everywhere in the world on all levels of income, for example, from the least for those who have the least and those who have more, but mostly for those who have least and so forth. So the thing is, the idea that we should change because, you know, we have this, you know, situation with respect to a warming planet, changing climate, is true. But there are far, far broader, deeper, more profound reasons to do them as well. And you go over every solution and, okay, water, cleanliness, purity, food, food security, health, education, livelihoods, dignified living wage jobs, you know, to give people a sense of purpose and meaning, you know. I mean, it just goes on and on and on and on. This is what the solutions to reversing global warming do. And so, again, I go back to the beginning of the conversation about the inertia of a system that is basically about extracting us. We're extracting each other, not just from the environment. Google is extractive. Facebook's extractive. All social media is extractive.
I guess anything that treats us, relates to us as a consumer, is extractive.
Absolutely. Advertising. Netflix is also extractive. It's deceptively extractive,
right,
in terms of the kind of programming it puts on, you know, what it chooses and so forth, you know, conforming to our baser instincts. It'll do good things once in a while, but it, basically most movies, most media out there is really conforming to our baser instincts of fear and threat and danger and violence and harm and, you know, all those kind of things. It's not really Joseph Campbell's hero's journey anymore.
Right. In other words, similar to we all, I think most of us at this point know that if something like Facebook, Instagram, any of those things are free, then you are the product.
Exactly right.
And yeah. And what you're saying is that the it's about knowing how to stimulate neurotransmitters, which is pretty stealthy when you think about it. And you're saying even programming that isn't as obviously as extractive as Google or Facebook, still, if it's only cultivating certain excitations, certain irritabilities, it's selling us way short.
Absolutely, and that's what Big Food does, because Big Food basically hacked our taste buds. We desire sugar, fat, and salt for very, very good reason, because for hundreds of thousands of years, those were difficult to come by. And so we were very careful, you know, I mean, when we slaughtered an animal, if we were hunter-gatherers and so forth, we actually divided the fat all the way around. You know, we didn't just take all the fat from one person and then you get the kidney. We didn't eat that way even, you know. So we knew that these things were crucially important. Now, basically, 60%+ of our food in the United States is ultra-processed food, high in salt, high in sugar, high in fat. And that is causing 70% of our disease, metabolic disease, that is being then taken advantage of by pharma, big pharma, which basically creates drugs you have to take for the rest of your life to deal with metabolic diseases caused by big food. And big food then also causes basically big ag, or enables it, because it specifies exactly, it's soy and corn. It wants soy for isolate proteins, it wants corn for sugar, wants soy for fat, and the salt is easy to get from the ocean. And between those three, man, it's making these concoctions and so forth that are addictive. They're literally addictive. And those desires, you know, are in us, and they're there for a reason. We have a
desire
for drugs, sex, and rock and roll too, but we are careful as a culture, you know, not to pander to those desires and so forth, but to, you know, and so, yeah, but we are extracting each other, you know?
Yes. And so that, I mean, I'm not even sure I got it as clearly in reading it, but that distinction, that pivot is at the core of regeneration, from extracting our life, our energy, our focus, our attention, all of that, to actually generating it instead of extracting it. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, if 74% of our population is overweight and obese, you know, with all the attendant problems thereof, high blood pressure, you know, heart disease.
Oh, and the difference in how obesity dictated your response to COVID is phenomenal. In other words, whether you'd be hospitalized, whether you die, obesity was, as far as I've read, the greatest indicator.
It truly, and the point being is that's degeneration. We are degenerating each other. And what I'm saying in regeneration is actually regeneration as at the very heart of who we are. We are life, and life creates the conditions for life. And we regenerate every day. Our 30 trillion cells are regenerating every nanosecond right now, or people wouldn't be listening and we wouldn't be talking. And the fact is that everything we do, when we care, take care of our family, our children, our friends, our habitat, our pets, our, when we worship together or pray, you know, in our temples, our synagogues, our mosques, our churches and so forth, you know, all that is about expressing gratitude and care. We are innately regenerative beings, and we have basically deluded ourselves as to who we are and why we're here. And what I say is that if we are not here now to regenerate life on Earth, because we're losing it, then why are we here at all? Why?
Yeah. What do you say after that, you know? But it goes back to that curiosity. Why are we here if that's it? So I think what we've done so far is really establish kind of the big picture, and at the same time, the deep core of what we're talking about. It's a shift in perspective. It's a shift in how you think about solving a problem, because some of the things that are very clear is that connection is at the core of this versus separation and individuation. Connection with the rest of nature. So this isn't about an environment out there or a climate problem out there. This is about our relationship with the rest of life. Let's, in the 10, 15 minutes we've got, 10 or 12 minutes we've got left, talk about how this, for instance, some of the emerging solutions that you point out, whether it's the breakthroughs in wind, microgrids, the azolla fern, some things that would just tickle people's, tickle people's interest in answering your wife's question, what do we do?
Well, usually when I answer that question, it was a little bit disingenuous, but I said, I don't know what you should do because I don't know you. And that was honest, and that's a true response. But I knew on a deeper level, I didn't know what to say when I was getting that question. So one of the things I recommend is, like, the purpose of the book is a neurotransmitter, if you will, okay? The last 8 pages is, I'm going to mix my metaphors here, is a wormhole to the website. The website is the most important part of the whole thing, not the book, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the book and the website is absolutely free and doesn't use any paper. And so there you have, now, incomplete in terms of filling out how to do them, and I'll get back to that in a minute in Nexus, but you have a list of 130 solutions. You have punch lists, which are people saying and sharing what their top commitments are as to what they do. But there you have in a huge variety of things that really do make a difference. And you mentioned azolla fern, but it's fire ecology, wilding, electrifying one's home, there's all sorts of things that are in there. I mean, the thing you quote should, because I can't say what you should do,
right?
Only you can say that, is the thing that lights you up. The thing that just really gets your mojo going, and we wake up and go, I can't wait to fill in the blank. Nobody wakes up in the morning and says, I can't wait to mitigate.
Yeah.
Right. And so, again, this goes to the language we've used, Terrence. The language has been appalling, just like inept in terms of engagement and inclusion and inspiration and so forth. We talk about climate change. What's wrong with that sentence? Two things wrong. One is, again, we're othering it. When you fight something, tackle it, combat it, it's not you. It's entirely separate. And we live in a world of profound othering, of people, of women, of gender, of sexuality, of race, of religion, of belief, etc. And it's getting worse in terms of that. At the same time, and so forth, we're going to fight climate change? Really? Really? The climate changes every nanosecond. It's supposed to change. It's perfect right now. It is perfect what it's doing because nature never makes a mistake. Hello. Okay. And so it is a reflection of what we are doing. It's not about stopping climate change. It's about stopping the things that are causing the climate to change. Hello. And so... so again, we've separated ourselves, the Bill Gatesian thing about, quote, fix it, with mm-hmm, air quotes on mm-hmm. it. It's like, it? Hey, Bill, let's go for the walk in the Cascades and maybe you can show me where you found the it, because I don't know where it is. It's us. It's the whole tamale. It's this beautiful, extraordinary, miraculous system we call the Earth, you know, this planet Earth. And it is, Terrence, I mean, it's homeschooling us. That's what's going on. We're being homeschooled. You know?
Yeah.
And the lesson, well, lesson plan number one, you know, is like, be in alignment with life. What a good idea for yourself, your own body, you know, but for everything else that you do.
Yeah.
Putting life at the center of every single act and decision. And you won't be perfect. You can't get it right the first time or the second time. But if that's the direction you're going, then you are bringing yourself and the world back to life. And that's what gives one a sense of purpose and meaning at this time in human history.
So, in answering the question of what do I do, what do you do, what does he or she or they do, it's what lights you up, it's what excites you, it's what challenges you, it's what turns you on. And what you're saying is when you do that, then things open up almost. Energy opens up, your creativity opens up, your relationships open up, and now you're moving in the right direction. And we know it's going to take collective action. So that whole question of what do I do, what do, is almost a distraction, because although we each have to live our own lives and take actions and care about things, this is all about us being in it together.
Exactly. And it's not that what you do is a distraction, it's an inception. And the inception is I'm connected to many, many other people. I'm not just an individual. I have my network. My network is my people, my friends, my family, my children, my relatives, my community, the people I associate with, my clubs, my classrooms, my city, you know, my village, you know, my company, my business, my nonprofit. I can go on and on, you know, my soccer club, whatever. That is who we are. And so when we understand that all solutions are collective, and that what's been left out in the individuation of responsibility, which is what we've done, like this is what you can do, as if, you know, and people know that that's not sufficient.
That's
and then
right.
They look to the Conference of the Parties or big government, and they know that they are basically hogtied and dysfunctional. And then they go into despair and worry and anxiety, or they just shut down, really, and so forth. Understandable. We're human, you know, we're people. And so the answer, what lies is actually in action. Andrew Huberman at Stanford, a brilliant neuroscientist, says, you know, look, at as much as you want to believe that your beliefs change your actions, they do not. What changes your beliefs is your actions. And so regeneration is very much about a do book. Go do. Start doing. Find out what you want to do, for sure, you know. Maybe it's something you're just curious about, like me. I don't know how to do it. Let's find out, you know. I'll learn a lot, whatever it is. But the doing changes your beliefs about the world, about people, about yourself, and about what's possible. But it'll never change if you just ruminate with your beliefs.
Okay, let me ask you one last question, Paul. And before I do, I want to re-emphasize something you said, but make it clear to people. Regeneration, the book, which I know is on the New York Times bestseller list, is a beautiful book. It's beautifully illustrated. It's a bunch of bite-sized essays on, you know, everything from cities, to nature, to buildings, to food, to equity, all of that's in there. But as you said, what it is an inducement. It's an invitation. It's a challenge. It's an inspiration to a website that has a ton more information and will continue to grow. You've put together a big team that will continue to, you know, to supply the person who gets involved. But let me, so I want to make sure people know that. Cool book, great website, check it out. If I were to ask you, you're standing in the future, 10 or 15, 25 years have passed, you're looking back. Did we turn things around, and how did we do it?
What happened in 20, 25 years is that the climate movement, and I say that in the most amorphous sense of the word, Terrence. I mean, it's not led by anybody. There is no one organization. But that is to say, the movement to address global warming in a substantive and effective way will become, without question, the biggest movement on Earth. And the reason for that is singular, which is weather. And the way to look at that is this was the hottest summer in recorded human history, okay? This is the coldest summer for the rest of your life. That's where we are.
Oh, and right. When you said it, wait, what? But I see what you're saying. Everyone following is going to be a little warmer and a little warmer.
A little warmer. And so... So what we're looking at here is basically moving from the conceptual to the experiential, vicariously or directly, about the impacts of global warming. Global warming, what does it do? It changes two things. It changes the jet stream. It changes ocean currents. Okay, it's fluid dynamics, you know, it reacts to heat. And when that changes climate. And when the climate changes, it changes the weather. And the weather impacts people in terms of food, drought, flood, hurricanes, etc. Okay, so this is going to grow and grow and grow until people, it's going to be essentially experiential for virtually everybody on Earth. And that's when people wake up. They wake up when this happens, you know. And so the question is, what will we coalesce around? What will we organize around? What will be those instructions or acts and so forth that we will undertake at that time? And my guess is that what we are doing now may seem minuscule or small or regional or local and so forth, but you know, at the end of the day, that's all we can do. Because as a we, and yes, we hope policy changes, and yes, we hope that capitalism reforms itself. You know, good luck on that one. But but the fact of the matter is that we will turn to those people, to those groups, those organizations, and so forth. You know, those groups of farmers, you know, who've understood that they had to make the transition from industrial to regenerative ag to save their farm, their soil, their families, the pollinators, etc., and to be more resilient and to make their soils reservoirs again of water. I mean, there's so many examples of this and so forth. We'll turn to those who basically have already moved towards regenerative practices and acts in their cities, in their towns, in their farmlands, in their forests, in their cultures, in their schools and everything. And that's where we're going to go. What will it be like in 20, 25 years? I don't know. That's a wild card. But I do think that humanity will organize around saving itself. And it's not about saving the planet. It's about saving civilization.
Very good. So again, the latest book is Regeneration, Ending the Climate Crisis in One Generation. The websites are paulhawken.com, Paul, and then H-A-W-K-E-N, all one word, paulhawken.com, and regeneration.org. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, all one word. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 10 or 12 articles fleshing out that conversation, you can sign up at my site, or you can email me at temcnally@mac.com, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y. You can also subscribe and listen to Freeform Podcasts on Apple Podcasts and most podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts there or at my site. Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, George Packer. You can also follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to G in production, George Vassilopoulos of Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Paul Hawken. Great talking with you again. Keep up the good work.
You too, Terrence. Thank you. You've been doing this work for a long time, and I do nothing but admire and enjoy your work. Thank you so much.
Thank you.